Today, the way we think about evil, who deserves judgment, and what we should do about either might need to be refined.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
The way we talk about judgment very often is clearly incompatible with our traditional sensibilities as a culture. We just don't like the idea that people are going to be judged. On the other hand, as we get more comfortable with it, we begin slinging around judgment pretty readily with no qualms whatsoever. Those people are going to burn in Hades, you know, that kind of thing. I've mentioned this before, this idea before. But today, I'm not as much focused on how or whether there are truths in that, and there are, no doubt, and why it's so important, that will come up, but more how we have chosen to address this. I mean, for instance, and I'll give two specific examples. The first, one that we've grown somewhat comfortable with, for those who are familiar with it, from C.S. Lewis. And the other, one we are definitely not comfortable with, from Hannah Arendt, who is one of my favorite philosophers, thinkers, political scientists, sociologists. I don't know exactly what title to put on her, but she is a very sharp analyst from the mid-20th century and survived the Holocaust, went through the Holocaust in different places, and is a really sharp analyst about it. But anyway, she has a different approach to it that I think we also ought to look at. And these just have to do with an author saying, for instance, C.S. Lewis saying, he realizes in The Problem of Pain, a book that you can read by C.S. Lewis, he realizes that judgment, and especially the idea of hell, is really uncomfortable to us. Why a loving God would send a person to hell. And so his address of the problem and the favorite part of what he says about it, there are parts of it that I think are a little questionable, you know, in his dealing with it. And I don't mean by that to question his theology overall, but simply to say there are parts of it I think a lot of people would respond to by saying, oh, yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to say that, dealing with the permanence, for instance, of the state of condemnation and so on. Or even with the sovereignty of God and the power that God has, some of the language that he uses is a little uncomfortable to people. But there's one part that everyone's taken up from what C.S. Lewis says that people have found comforting when talking about judgment. And the only thing wrong with this, and I'm going to read it to you in just a moment. It's just a single line or two, but it will make the point of what people have taken up from C.S. Lewis's discussion of judgment when he describes why a person would end up being in hell forever and how that might make sense to us. He does put it in a way that sort of makes sense to us. He says, I willingly believe that the damned are, in one sense, successful rebels to the end, that the doors of hell are locked on the inside. And then he says, I don't mean that they don't wish to come out of hell. Of course, they do in some vague way. But I do mean they would rather, and I'm not reading him anymore, but just paraphrasing from this point, but they would rather face that judgment for eternity than ever have to face some kind of submission or obedience to God. And so it's actually the person's choice to be there, not just to go there and then arrive there and want to say, oh, no, let me out, and then God's just not merciful anymore. C.S. Lewis says, no, the mercy of God is never ending. The point is that they don't want out. I mean, they want out, but they want out with their rebellion, but instead they're successful rebels, and they get to stay there without submitting to God for all of eternity. And so he puts all of the blame on the person. And that makes sense in some ways. And I'm not saying it's a poor argument or that it's not the case. I'm not saying any of that. But I am saying When we take that approach, and it may be a fine approach, it may be true. When we take that approach, what happens to us psychologically, mentally, is that we become susceptible to sort of caricaturing the evil of those who deserve judgment as being worse than what it would be for us. Now, to C.S. Lewis's credit, he makes the point that this is not about others, but about us. He makes the point that we should be careful about this, but warning us to be careful doesn't seem to have kept us from making the error. And so the way it ends up being caricatured is someone, and C.S. Lewis actually uses language like this to help us understand why it might make sense for a person to face eternal judgment. You know, somebody is foaming at the mouth, being dragged away from the court, saying they're glad they murdered someone and they don't care what we think about it. And when that person faces the gallows, then their judgment makes sense to us. He's trying to create a parallel to that, but in the sense that the person's just recalcitrant. They don't care about the opportunity to get out of hell the only way that they could, by submitting to God. And so they stay there instead, by their own choice. The doors are locked from the inside, is the metaphor that he uses. So the fact that that leaves us with the option of thinking about the psychology of people who face that kind of judgment as somehow distinct from the psychology we have, because we would certainly not choose that over the submission to God or something like that, is the only part that makes me pause and say, we should be thinking more differently from that, because the judgment that's out there, the evil that's out there, clings a lot more readily to us than we would like to admit. And I realize none of us want to hear that. None of us want to think that. But I am saying to you, I remember visiting a hog farm one time. And when we went, I was preaching at a church for a revival. And when we got back to the church, we walked in the building. And, you know, I mean, we were done. You know, we'd been away from the hog farm for 45 minutes. We got back to the church building and we walked in. And the first person that met us lifted their nose and said, y'all been to the hog farm? Because everybody could smell us. Everyone in the building could tell that odor was sticking to us. And I don't think we didn't smell it. We didn't realize it. I mean, of course, once they said it, we realized it and wanted to do something about it. And those clothes from then on, you know, needed to go in an inferno. They needed to go away. I think, you know, the odor of evil clings a lot more readily to us than we would like to admit. And I am dismayed at how resistant we are to this idea. I communicate it all the time. I am constantly saying how important it is that our repentance be ongoing, that our humility, that our contrition before God be constant, that we recognize how dependent we are every day on God for grace. And it is I'm not saying individuals that I could point at are fighting against me or something like that, but it just does not, that truth, that idea doesn't stick to us as well as the evil does. And so, you know, the person who really makes this point in the middle of the 20th century after the Holocaust was Hannah Arendt, the person I've mentioned before. And she has a particular book. I've quoted her in episodes before this as well. But or at least I've referred to her. She has a book that was written in 1963, I believe, just after the trial of Eichmann in Jerusalem. And it's called Eichmann in Jerusalem. It's based on a series of articles that she did for The New Yorker, I believe. And it's the subtitle of it is called A Report on the Banality of Evil. And that phrase, the banality of evil, is Hannah Arendt's phrase. And so I want to read to you just a couple of sections of what she says, because it was earth-shattering when she said it, and it is earth-shattering to those who haven't recognized it yet. And so at this trial, you know, Adolf Eichmann, he's the guy that was kidnapped out of South America and taken back to Jerusalem for the trial and then finally hanged in Jerusalem for his crimes against humanity, and in particular, his participation in the Holocaust against the Jews. So obviously it was carried out in Jerusalem. And there's all kinds of discussion that's to be had about that, that I would love to have another episode about that. Again, Hannah Arendt is the person who gives the best analysis of. But anyway, as she was reporting on the trial, in her epilogue after the trial, one of the things in the book that she puts out, which is that series of articles that she was writing during the trial, part of the epilogue makes the point that Eichmann is not the monster that we want him to be. And in fact, when the Nuremberg trials were going on just after World War II, and when some of the principal violators of human rights were first being tried by an international court, the characterization of them as beasts or as monsters was common, and the sense that something so atrocious had happened and that normal people could not do that was the sense that most of us were carrying out of it. But it's Hannah Arendt who made the point that that's a completely mistaken interpretation of what happened. In fact, she says this. This is a quote from Eichmann in Jerusalem, and this is in her epilogue, I believe. She says this, "The trouble with Eichmann was precisely that so many were like him." And I'm going to pause here. This, I'm not reading her anymore. Just hear this for a second. "But as they were analyzing Eichmann and had psychologists discuss things with him or the prosecutors ask him questions to try to say what a monster he was, what he really proved was that he was more ordinary, more stable than most of the people who were talking to him. He was very level-headed, very ordinary, committed to a specific ethical idea." I'll discuss it later and mention what happened with that. "He had to turn that off in order to obey the laws that were being passed in Germany at the time and to obey the culture and what it was doing with Jews and gypsies and others at the same time." And so here's what she says. "The trouble with Eichmann was precisely that there were so many like him." This is, and she goes on to say, "and that the many were neither perverted nor sadistic, that they were and still are terribly and terrifyingly normal. From the viewpoint of our legal institutions and of our moral standards of judgment, this normality was much more terrifying than all the atrocities put together, for it implied, as had been said at Nuremberg over and over again by the defendants and their counsels, that this new type of criminal, who is in actual fact hostis generis humani, this enemy of humanity, commits his crimes under circumstances that make it well nigh impossible for him to know or to feel that he is doing wrong. And we're not saying that because he's a sociopath. That's not the point here. It's not he didn't have a conscience. The problem with a person like Adolf Eichmann is that he clearly did have a conscience, that he was acting in obedience to the things he saw coming as irrefutable and irrevocable commands, guidance from the culture as a whole and from his leaders and from law itself. He didn't just say norms of society. He would repeatedly in the trial refer to the laws, that he was obeying laws in order to do what he did. That normality of evil is really scary to us. And I don't think simply because we don't like the idea of, you know, a character like the one in Silence of the Lambs. It's not just that, a Hannibal Lecter, you know. That person is scarier than a Frankenstein monster, you know, that you can see and identify. It's not just that. It's that it really does look a lot like us. And it makes it more troubling for us to be honest about where we might be evil. You know, we might be doing things that are wrong. The other half, by the way, of Hannah Arendt's statement that I wanted to mention is in a chapter in the middle of her book called Law Abiding Citizen, if I remember the title of the chapter correctly. And it's where she says that, and just listen to this, because this is the point I want to make today, because we're approaching the 50th anniversary, not quite 50, but almost 50 years since Roe v. Wade became the law of the land. And I know we're thinking, oh, well, it's about to be overturned. The Supreme Court's going to step up and do its job, which is fine. That may happen. I hope it does happen. But our thought about what that means, I think, is mistaken. And what it means for us is mistaken. And where we are in our relationship with all that's gone on over these almost 50 years of this practice of abortion in America is part of what I want to get to. But to get to that, we really need to grasp this one idea. And so here it said. Now, I'm not just talking about laws. This is not just about judgments. But here, the laws as this ensconcement of cultural norms at their highest level. And then we just want to talk about what those cultural norms mean for us as we're moving forward in the discussion today. So this is what she says in that chapter on law-abiding citizen. It's the last paragraph in that chapter. And just as the law in civilized countries, and by the way, the fact that she says civilized countries introduces a problem of its own that she doesn't recognize. I mean, there's a book called The Civilizing Process now. It came from two other books, one called The History of Manners and the other called The Rise of Civilization. Those two books were combined into The Civilizing Process by Norbert Elias. That book, the book that defines Western civilization for us, and we still teach in humanities classes, it is still the source of information about how Erasmus helped shape the way we understand manners and so on. All of those things, that background to understand why we would consider one culture civilized and another culture not civilized. I'm not saying there are no prejudices in it, believe me, I'm about to emphasize that. That book, the book that identifies what it is to be civilized, was written, I believe, published first in 1939 in Germany. 1939, right in the middle of the Holocaust. And this is Hannah Arendt, a sincere critic of all that was happening during that time, and one of the sharpest, most acute critics of that time. And she says civilized countries would be in contrast to what was happening in Germany. That's a real revelation about how trapped we can be not seeing how evil can creep into what we think is civilization. And again, don't hear this apocalyptically. I'm saying it about every culture throughout all of history. It's true about human nature. We have to recognize that we're not the exception. And in so doing, then recognize how dependent we are on grace, on God's grace, instead of all the other things that make us so proud of ourselves and think we're accomplishing so much to be immune to the hazards that have infected the rest of the world or other people in our own culture. And so she says this, just as the law in civilized countries assumes that the voice of conscience tells everybody, thou shalt not kill, even though man's natural desires and inclinations may at times be murderous. So the law of Hitler's land demanded the opposite, she's going to say, that the voice of conscience tell everybody, thou shalt kill, although the organizers of the massacres knew full well that murder is against the normal desires and inclinations of most people. Evil in the Third Reich had lost the quality by which most people recognize it, the quality of temptation. Many Germans and many Nazis, probably an overwhelming majority of them, must have been tempted not to murder. And I wish I had time to just dwell only on this. Eichmann, in his trial, talks about how embarrassed he was that he had saved some Jews from their destruction, that he had gone out of his way to rescue a good Jew here or there from what was happening, and that he was embarrassed when he had to tell his superiors that he had done that and had to apologize for it and make things right. And you could tell in his own conscience that in order to make it right, he had to decide he would never do that again. That's what this is about, these lines. Many Germans and many Nazis, probably an overwhelming majority of them, must have been tempted not to murder, not to rob, not to let their neighbors go off to their doom, for that the Jews were transported to their doom. They knew. She's saying they were aware. The people who said, oh, we didn't know, she's saying that's not an excuse. We know better than that. They knew. That the Jews were transported to their doom, they knew, of course, even though many of them may not have known the gruesome details, and not to become accomplices in all these crimes by benefiting from them. But God knows they had learned how to resist temptation. It's a brilliantly ironic line at the end of that chapter to make the point that temptation in their society had become the temptation to do what was right. And that's this is when you hear Paul's language in Romans 1, you have to recognize this is what he's describing. We'd like to think he's just describing the excesses of the Roman Empire. It's not just the excesses of the Roman Empire. It's not just a book that speaks to that particular moment in Rome. You know what I'm talking about when he says they call good evil and evil good. That's the danger of every culture. God gives us a conscience that's aware, according to Romans 2, of what's right and wrong and condemns or condones the things that we're doing. But our nature as human beings in a culture is to find a way to teach each other that the real temptation is when you're being tempted to do the right thing in contrast to what the culture has taught you over and over is okay. It's okay to do this. It's okay to have that party that way. It's okay to have to participate in this kind of violation of someone else's rights. It's okay to throw objects at someone if you don't like the way they're voting. It's okay to howl someone out of the building if they stand on the opposite side of politics from you. No, that's okay. And we convince ourselves that good is evil and evil is good. And so Hannah Arendt is making that point in her book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. And that's what I think we need to become aware of, that as the way she's characterized as having said it, and I didn't look for this quote, so I'm not quoting her, but I've seen plenty of authors describe her this way, and I know this is true about the way she thinks about things, not only in this, but in the book she talks about revolutions in America and France, she does the same thing, that good is a thing. She believes that. Good is a thing in itself. It stands upright. This is Thomistic, by the way, if you know Thomas Aquinas. That good actually is a thing. And therefore, good can be radical. Radical means it can act against all of the forces that were pushing in a certain direction. Evil is not. Evil is the privation of good. And this is, I'm saying it Thomistically. Now, I don't agree completely with that. I think there is a real thing that is evil. I think it exists ontologically. But that doesn't change this, that when we're committing evil acts, it's because we're not doing the right thing. We are not doing good. And so what Hannah Arendt makes the point of is that when you're doing good, you can act radically against your culture and actually take a stand, be the John the Baptist on the other side of the river. But when you're doing evil, it's more like a fungus. It just grows among us, and we begin to do these things. And you can be extreme, so there can be a person who's doing it worse than anyone else, but it's always going to be a reflection of something in the culture, or something in the circumstance, something in the context that makes you think. You know, in the words of the proverb, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. That's describing this sort of deceptive nature of evil to permeate more than we think. And this is my point, that evil is a lot more normal than we think. I don't mean by that there's no good. I don't mean by that at all, that there's no way for us to obey. I don't mean that at all. That's the point of this discussion, is that there is a way for us to obey. But we can't get there if we're not willing to recognize how much more normal evil is in our nature and in our culture than we think. So in this particular occasion, let me illustrate in the way that's appropriate to the week when this podcast is, when this episode is being released. Our culture has normalized the pall of abortion. I do not mean by that simply that we have normalized the act of abortion. I mean abortion and the whole dispute that goes around it and the industry that supports it and opposes it, the whole practice of abortion and its discussion and the way we regard it in relation to women and to children and to church and to school and to liberties and all of that has become normalized in our culture. Opponents of abortion, and that's me. I'm an opponent of abortion. I want it to stop. I wish there were no abortion. I wish it didn't happen. Opponents of abortion would like to see it, would like to believe, and I know better than this, we would like to believe that it's a flaw in American culture. You know, this thing just slipped in, and because of a Supreme Court ruling, you know, we started making it acceptable, and you know, there have been 50 million abortions, but it's just because of this mistake in a court. And if we can just get that overturned, I think we can get rid of this problem. Think about the magnitude of this practice in our culture. Think about the depth at which it expresses the core of the divide in our culture. The culture wars have endured for these 50 years. They have been a persistent feature of American life for 50 years, and nobody's grown tired of them. I don't mean nobody. Of course, some have. I have. I've been talking about it in every episode we've done almost. But the culture wars are raging on, and the people on both sides are, you know, pinning badges on each other and talking about how great they are and looking for the opportunity to slaughter someone on the other side. We love staying in the culture war, and abortion is so deeply embedded in it that we avoid the topic in most classrooms. I've been in higher ed for more than 20 years now. We avoid it in most classrooms. We avoid it in family discussions. We avoid it in church discussions. Because two reasons. One, it's too divisive, or two, it's passé. We've already had all those discussions. We already know the end of all those arguments. Why even bring it up anymore? That's how deeply embedded abortion is in it. It hasn't gone away simply because we avoid discussing it now. It is still just as prominent a feature of our culture as it was in 1973 or in 1979 or in 1992, key dates in the abortion battle. As it's described, that is a feature of American culture, not a flaw in American culture. It's not a blip on the radar, and it's not going away no matter what we think about it. To the culture, it is not a flaw that there are two sides to the abortion issue. It is a feature. It's a way to focus on the battle between conservatism and liberalism, which words I hope to talk about later in the discussion that we're having. So it's not a flaw to them. And to, you know, to the proponents of abortion, it is progress on women's rights. It's not just the matter of abortion. It is a matter of privacy. It's a matter of reproductive rights. It's a matter of liberty or autonomy or sexual liberation. The whole 1960s and the conclusion of them culminates in abortion. The idea that abortion by itself creates those things, or the desire for them, or the way they're ensconced, or the way they're intertwined, or the way they're defended, is a mistake. That's not understanding the culture. It is embedded in our culture. To the opponents like me, the entire industry of, and by the way, I'll say this about my side of it. The whole industry that's been opposed to abortion has not been supporting babies and mothers the way we should. I know some who do. They are tremendous at it. I'm thinking of a woman named Carolyn Klein, I know, who does a beautiful job of it in Dallas and in the Dallas area and all of the ministries that she leads. I'm 100% on board with the way she approaches it. So I'm not saying there's no one doing it when I say this, but I mean as a culture. It's not been about supporting babies and mothers. It's been about opposing the abortion industry. And because we have created this industry in opposition to the abortion industry, we're not going to know what to do with ourselves when Roe v. Wade is overturned on the assumption that it is. But I can guarantee you we're going to end up participating in exactly the same battles that we're fighting right now for reasons I'll describe in just a moment. So, you know, what's going to happen when the Supreme Court overturns the Mississippi law? Endorses the Mississippi law. And I'm just thinking of the current Supreme Court rulings. I don't know for sure how the court's going to rule, but it seems obvious in the gestures that they have made. Just think about it. What's going to happen? Number one, it's already happening. There are going to be efforts to create federal action to protect access to abortion, which means every political rally is going to be about women's rights and the progress on liberty and autonomy and reproductive rights and all of those things I was describing a moment ago. There are going to be state laws in the states that protect abortion rights. There are going to be state laws protecting abortion within those states. And they will be crammed with people who are driving there from Texas and other states that pass laws in order to keep abortion from being able to happen. I'm opposed to abortion, and I'm not against having laws that protect infants. I am for having laws that regard infants in the womb with the same kinds of protection that ought to be afforded to every person outside of the womb. That's what I've always thought about the issue of abortion, and I still believe it. I want that to happen. I'm simply describing what's going to persist in the culture, regardless of what we do with Roe v. Wade. State activism in pro-life states is going to begin to center around abortion rights. even just looking back a few years to what was happening with that state legislator who was trying to run for governor and so on, all of those things are evidence of where it's going to go. This doesn't mean we shouldn't oppose abortion. It doesn't mean I'm not going to oppose abortion. But it does mean if we want real change, we're going to have to aim higher and longer term than simply overthrowing Roe v. Wade or simply trying to win in flare-ups that we have against abortion advocates, which is what happens. You have a flare-up. Somebody passes a law, and it goes to the court, and then you have this raging battle for 6 months, and then it simmers down again, and it just becomes an industry again where people are going and finding their solutions for reproduction in whichever direction they're trying to go. So our culture has normalized this cloud, this dark cloud of abortion that's been a part of it for so long. We have also normalized other things that go with it. And I mentioned a few of those things. I'll just pick one right now. But we've normalized the marginalization of women. And where we've made progress, and I do mean we have made progress, we should treat women better. I'm not a radical feminist, but I am in favor of some of the things that feminists talk about because some of the things they're talking about just point out inequities that shouldn't exist. Does that mean I agree with everything? No, but let's just pick an example that is comfortable for those of us in the church world, especially the Billy Graham rule, which I'm not saying is Billy Graham's rule. That's just how it's referred to. The Billy Graham rule, what does that actually mean? So I read a student comment recently in a seminary-type setting, which was describing how belittling it felt after class to stand and watch the professor invite a male student to lunch to discuss some theological issue, to talk about ministry, to talk about opportunities in service, and blah, blah, blah. Over and over with one male student after another, one class period after another, and never to be invited because she was a woman in that class. You say, well, obviously he couldn't invite her. I mean, that would be lunch alone with a woman. You know, and I'm not saying I have a solution, but I am saying I can describe a problem. That's a problem. To think as an implication of, and this is not because of the Billy Graham rule, this is an implication that rule's prominence in a lot of people's lives reveals that what we think is that any time a man spends with any woman is dangerous time. Man, you just don't know what's going to happen. And why is that? Is it because men have no self-control? Then shouldn't we be addressing the issue of self-control instead of just regarding all women as inherently dangerous? Because that's the other option, that we're saying, oh, no, women are a threat. Either they're dangerous because of what could happen with them or because they're manipulative or because they're deceptive. Then we need to rethink personal meetings with men as well, because I'm pretty sure the sin nature doesn't extend uniquely to women. And if that's the case, then we should be rethinking how we have segregated women as dangerous or a problem. And just saying it with those words, doesn't it, in anyone's mind, doesn't it just raise the specter to you that in a lot of ways we've made our religious expressions more compatible, more similar to conservative Islamic practices? And I'm not saying all Islamic practices, but just those really conservative fundamentalist Islamic practices than we have to what the Bible describes. I'm just saying we have normalized this way of marginalizing women. And you can hear how gently I have to approach this topic. I'm just talking about it on something that's so conservatively rooted that maybe you would pause and go, yeah, that does seem a little unfair. Think about when we say a glass ceiling exists. Think about how significant that ceiling is when we say, yes, I can have these types of meetings with men, but not with women. That is a barrier to women in the workplace. Well, do we think women can work or not? And so on. I'm pointing it out in a way that should be palatable to those of us who are in the conservative world, I'm putting it in air quotes, or the religious world. We should recognize there is something amiss there. Well, in that way, we should recognize that these culture war issues, whether it has to do with women's rights or it has to do with abortion, are related because they're built into the structure of our culture, ongoing divisions. are part of the undergirding structure of any relationship or society. There's an article in, I'm trying to find the source of it here. Anyway, there's an article that I read, I'll come up with it in a moment, by Jeannie Suk Gerson, and you can find a link to it. I'm sure Daisy will create a link to it for you. And it's maybe in the Atlantic. I don't think it is. I think it's in the New Yorker or something like that. But anyway, it's called The Mississippi Abortion Case and the Fragile Legitimacy of the Supreme Court. And she is a Harvard law professor and writes about vigilantism in the article, comparing it to what's going on in the Supreme Court's review of the abortion cases right now, the Texas law, and then also the law in Mississippi. And she describes the vigilantism of Kyle Rittenhouse and also of in the case regarding Ahmaud Arbery, where the men were actually, found guilty. They were convicted for what they did. Kyle Rittenhouse was not found guilty for what he did. But in both cases, it's a form of vigilantism. So chasing down somebody you think is guilty of something, or Kyle Rittenhouse taking up arms to defend the law, you know, to defend order, law and order on his street or his grandmother's street, whatever it was. All of those things are vigilantism, and she's making the point that we're sort of taking that approach as well. That article's in the New Yorker. Thank you, Daisy. I appreciate you pointing that out. That in the article, you could read it and say, oh, this is just a liberal lamenting the possible overthrow of Roe v. Wade, but that would miss the point of the whole article. And by the way, it would give evidence of how poorly we listen to other people's opinions, because the article is not about that, about how to defend Roe v. Wade. The article is making this point that we have lost the value of precedent. We've lost the value of laws that actually recognize these structures within society as being important in themselves. Now, I'm not saying by that means Roe v. Wade could never be overthrown, but the approach we've taken to it now is to pass laws deliberately, sort of vigilante state laws, deliberately to overthrow a precedent that exists in the court. I get it. There are people who do that on both sides. I'm not blaming conservatives for it. They're just doing the same things liberals have done on the other side. I get it. I get it. It comes from both sides. The lamentation of this author, Jeannie Suk Gerson, is to make the point that it calls into question the court's very welcoming of laws that would overturn precedent, calls into question the structure, the stability that the court was supposed to provide, the Supreme Court was supposed to provide historically. Whether you think that's constitutional or not, it's what the court's been doing for a couple of hundred years. And we're losing that now, because the idea in the court now is you appoint the correct people. It's FDR. It's the approach that FDR wanted to take by stacking the court back then, and that Joe Biden wouldn't dismiss as a possibility when he was running for president either, of stacking the court to get the right number of justices on the court so you can pass whatever law you want. That's undermining the stability and structures of society and attacking those structures in order to get what you want in a political moment. The lamentation that this author gives to that is simply a recognition of how important those structures are to the society. Whether you think they're good, bad, or indifferent, it was a recognition not that there's simply a political wave happening right now, but that there is an undermining of the structures of democracy, the structures of our government that's taking place right now. And that's what's happening with election laws right now in exactly the same way. So if we're going to make a difference, we're going to have to make a difference in a different way. We're going to have to think differently about to have an influence or a representation of what's right in our society than simply charging into issues. So as we talk about how to do that differently, we have to commit ourselves to a different structure than the ones that are imposing on us from the culture. So if the culture wars, for instance, represent that structure, then we have to commit ourselves to a different structure. And that's what ethics is about. And I teach ethics at Criswell College. I love it. When I get to teach ethics at Criswell, I love doing it because that's what a real ethic is about. And I'm only going to give this to you in a brief form right now. We'll do another episode entirely on how to do this in detail. But, you know, ethics is about having a structure in place which governs your actions when everything else wants you to do otherwise. So, for instance, and this would be a parallel, just a metaphor for an ethic, hunters would have an ethic, so to speak, that you don't shoot what you can't see. That way, when you're trigger happy and you've been waiting all morning and you think, oh, maybe that is a deer rustling in the bush, you don't shoot your relative or your friend who's hunting with you. And the reason you don't isn't because you don't want to shoot in the moment or because you didn't see an antler in the moment, but because you can't see what you're about to shoot. And you have a rule that you don't shoot what you're about to hope, that you don't shoot what you can't see. So in democracy, let me give it this context. Winning, that is the urgency of the moment and getting what you need, requires gerrymandering and restricting who can vote. And both sides do it whenever it comes to their advantage, both sides. I'm embarrassed that both sides do it because I want to be part of a side that says, no, I'm going to do what's right, not what's going to win in the moment. But that's not what we do. So winning calls for, you know, restricting votes, gerrymandering, stuff like that. If I were to promote the structure of democracy, then regardless, I would be defending the tenets that underlie that democracy, the legitimacy of the election process, for instance. And I would be finding ways to support that. I would be finding ways to make sure that the entire population is represented in votes, not just the parts of the population that will ensure that each district represents the values that I think ought to be ensconced in the law. Even when the values are critically important, if I don't support the structure of the society that can make it right, then it will not end up being right, even if I win in a given moment. In a church setting, this happens all of the time. We, instead of maximizing the participation, and I'm saying this in a Baptist church setting, in Baptist polity, the lordship of Jesus is expressed in the congregation through democratic processes. That's a line in the Baptist faith and message. I believe in that. I believe in the congregation being able to speak to things. Using parliamentary tricks to keep people from being able to express their will in a church business meeting, for instance, or a church conference, is unethical if we're committed to that truth, that the lordship of Jesus is expressed in democratic processes. The less democratic we become, the less we express this doctrinal commitment we say that we have. So you can understand what I'm getting at. Let me apply that again to abortion really quickly. I'm not saying this as one who would, you know, have us move past caring about abortion. That's not me. I'm not that person. I am saying this as someone who is heartbroken that a million times a year, a woman wakes up knowing she has a life that she did not expect or doesn't know what to do with and believes that the best option is to make that little life go away or cease to be. I'm dealing with that. That's what I want us to address. Not just a law, not just pushing them to another state to go find it, not just making it less convenient, but that reality, that's what has to change. I'm a person who is equally heartbroken that after 50 years of ranting and praying and battling and suing and marching and protesting, abortion options are either multiplying or simply moving to different methods or locations. And I'm one who wants to see our, as a culture, our attitude toward the gift of human life change, our understanding of humanity and its importance change. Now, I'm not pretending that I've given an answer to getting there. I am simply saying we should be more honest about recognizing that when we simply play our role in the way this culture is addressing this issue right now, we are imbued with the smell that comes from our culture. We are touched by that odor of evil. And as believers, we're supposed to carry a scent from a different place, from heaven. So let me read it to you this way in James, who's dealing with people and saying to them, don't get caught up in knee-jerk reactions. Don't practice judgment the way the world practices judgment. And it's more in terms of how the church relates with each other, but he's dealing with it very specifically also in the presence of non-believers. And he says this, be patient therefore, brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the former waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until he receives the early and the latter rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, because the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brothers, so that you may not be judged. Behold, the judge stands before the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast. You have heard of the steadfastness of Job. You have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Hear this, the things the Spirit produces in believers, regardless of context, regardless of what's happening in the culture, regardless of who wins or is competing in an election. The things the Spirit produces in believers, regardless of context, are the things we can commit to regardless of what is persisting or changing, reinforcing or challenging us in our culture. Patience, willingness to suffer, compassion, and mercy. Those are the scent we should be bringing to our culture.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.